This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Carrie Fisher was America's princess, Princess Leia, of course, but also she was born to Hollywood royalty, daughter of the heartthrob crooner Eddie Fisher and the gorgeous girl next door actress Debbie Reynolds. Carrie Fisher became a bigger star than both of her parents when she was just 20 years old. Little did she, or anyone else, frankly, know how big Star Wars would become and how it would come to dominate her life. But she reinvented herself as a writer and as a comedic actor. Privately, though, she battled mental illness and drug addiction.
My entire life could be summed up in one phrase. If my life wasn't funny, it would just be true. And that is completely unacceptable.
Carrie Fisher died 3 years ago of cardiac arrest. She was just 60 years old. Sheila Weller chronicles her story in a new biography. It's called Carrie Fisher, A Life on the Edge. And Sheila Weller joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Great to have you. Well, she grew up in Beverly Hills. What was her childhood like?
Well, she, at the age of two, her father ran off with Elizabeth Taylor, and that was the scandal of America. That was kind of the end of the perfect 50s romantic couple, wholesome couple that Debbie and Eddie personified, and the beginning of a more realistic era. But she had flash bulbs popping in her face. She had paparazzi on her lawn, and probably felt as rejected by her father as her mother may have felt. So a kind of lifelong bond with her mother was sealed at that point. And there was a lot of childish cynicism about paparazzi and about fame, and she got it very young.
We think that she burst onto the scene when she was just 20 in Star Wars, but in fact, she had been in Shampoo when she was younger. How old was she when she was in Shampoo?
Gee, I'm trying to remember now. I think 18 or 19.
Okay.
She sidled up to Warren Beatty. Of course, Warren Beatty was a friend of her mother's, and her mother was good friends with Shirley MacLaine, and went to the rehearsal, went to meet him with no makeup on, acting like she didn't give a damn about getting the role, and she won it without a bit of a rehearsal. He was quite taken with her aplomb and her confidence and her attitude and gave her the role.
Here is her memorable scene with Warren Beatty.
You know, I think you got exactly the same eyes as your mother, and your chin's a little bit like hers, too.
No, it isn't.
I think it is.
No, and my eyes aren't like hers either.
They are.
No, they're not.
They are.
No, they're not.
I'm really not
like my mother.
I'm not trying to insult you, you know. But can't we just be friends?
Okay. You want to f***?
Wow. Well, I guess she didn't write the lines, but she sure delivered them.
She did, and she and Warren Beatty talked her mother into letting her say that. Her mother, of course, came from a very religious background in El Paso and was against using words like that. But Carrie insisted on it, and it didn't take much for Debbie to say, okay, let's do it. She was a real pro.
All right. And so then, as you say, a year later, the role that would define her career, at least in the first part.
My ship has fallen under attack, and I'm afraid my mission to bring you to Alderaan has failed. I have placed information vital to the survival of the rebellion into the memory systems of this R2 unit. My father will know how to retrieve it. You must see this droid safely delivered to him on Alderaan. This is our most desperate hour. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
How did she, through the years, come to view her role? Did she appreciate it? Did she resent it? Was it a combination of that?
I don't think she resented it. People told me she made fun of the whole thing. And obviously, there was a spoofability about it. And it was an incredible opportunity. It was an incredible branding for her. And so she really loved it. And at the end, in The Princess Diarist, in her last books, she talked about how much she loved it, how important it was to meet the fans. But people told me when she did movies with them or had dinner with them or hung out with them, she would make fun of it and tell funny Star Wars stories. But it was affectionate fun.
She had an affair with Harrison Ford at the time, but didn't reveal it for many years.
She revealed it at the very end of her life in the book The Princess Diarist.
And why did she not speak of it sooner?
Don't know, really. I mean, it seemed to me that of all the people she knew, and she was very charismatic and wasn't intimidated easily, he seemed to be somebody who could kind of intimidate her, and she didn't want to do that. So I think she kept it private.
So she becomes a bona fide celebrity, a star. She's very young. And this is in the 70s. And there's a lot of partying going on. I guess there's always a lot of partying going on in celebrity circles.
Right.
But how did she begin using drugs?
She was an undiagnosed bipolar at the time. It was called manic depression. And used Percocet, Percodan. Those words are interchangeable. What we then called painkillers, but now we call opioids, to kind of quell the mania. And that was a very common thing for people who were bipolar and didn't know it, or maybe were bipolar and knew it, to use. So it was both that and cocaine. And some people could do cocaine as a quote-unquote recreational drug. That was the term that was used at the time. And some people had more of a susceptibility to it. And I believe, and her friends would sort of say, that she had a susceptibility to it.
And I want to just play a scene of her talking about it. This is from her one-woman show that she did way later in life in 2010 called Wishful Drinking, which became an HBO special.
My mother wants you all to know this comes from my father's side. She is as normal as the day is long. Now, my diagnosis, I know this will stun you, was manic depression. I think more now they call it bipolar, right? So you might say I swing both ways.
But it's a good line. But it took her a long time to come out publicly about her mental illness.
It was December 2000. She was on Diane Sawyer and she said, I am mentally ill. I can say that. But she came out about everything. She came out about her drug use. She came out about her manicness in different ways. I mean, she didn't say I'm mentally ill. I can say that until 2000. But I don't think she was withholding it. I mean, you really knew who she was. You knew she had excesses, and she tried to combat them, and she also tried to live with them, and she made fun of them, and she shared them with people who did or did not. And it was that blazing honesty that was so unique about her and so characteristic of her. So even though it took her a long time to actually say it in that interview, I don't think she ever hid it.
But when she was hardcore doing drugs and partying, there were quite a few instances of her overdosing and having to be quickly ferried to a hospital, in some cases having her stomach pumped. None of that really made it into the press at the time.
And I think people knew something. People had some sense that she suffered from this. And drug addiction is a disease. We have to remember that. Yeah. We didn't know it that well back then.
So how did all of this, her personal experiences, her trauma, her relationship with her mother, which was complicated, how did all of that enter into her writing?
She wrote about all of it. Postcards was about being a sophisticated
young woman. This is Postcards from the Edge.
From the Edge, right. Her breakout work of what she called faction, half fact, half fiction. But it was her life through the lens of half fictionalizing it, making fun of it, using the last names of some of her friends and, you know, tossing them around. I mean, I got to know some of the people in her life, and I got to know the names of many people in her life, and I would see these last names and these first names and kind of smile. They were kind of private jokes. But becoming a writer was very important. And I think as a girl, she wanted to be a writer. She read the great literary artists and really hungered for that, and she attained it.
So she went into rehab, and she was treated for her drug addiction and was on various medications to treat her bipolar disease, and seemed to be on the mend, I guess, towards the end of her life. And she was in London filming a TV show and was on a plane back to Los Angeles when she went into cardiac arrest.
Right.
Were drugs involved in her death?
Well, the toxicology report was delayed for a long time. Nobody knows why, really, but there were some drugs in that toxicology report. Ecstasy was one. I think there was a tiny bit of heroin. Some of these, they didn't know when they were ingested, how close to her time of death she had taken them or been around them. But there were several drugs, and that made headlines. She had many things going on. She had been ill. She had had bronchitis a lot. She had gained weight. She was on many medications, both for bipolar disorder, which, you know, you're changing your meds. Some meds don't work. You go on other meds. You have a number of medications that you're on at the same time. And some of her friends thought, in fact, those medications were what, you know, kind of did her in. But I think it was a combination of things and a great deal of moving around. I mean, it was a very active last 4 years of her life.
Do you think that she was in a good place mentally when she died? Was she happy? Was she?
A friend of hers said he kind of felt she lived her life. And if she was perhaps feckless with taking some drugs, it was the sense that, okay, I can do it now. I mean, I've kind of lived long enough. I mean, that's one person's feeling. A lot of good things were going on. She was going to do another wishful drinking themed on Star Wars. She had many things in the works and always did. I mean, she was incredibly prolific. I was just amazed at how many scripts she doctored and how many movies she was in, even in small roles, how many friends she had, how many places she went. So in one sense, she was incredibly alive and full of hope, and she had just enlarged or remodeled her house. But she often did go back to habits that her friends did not want her to go back to or thought were unsafe, and this might have been one of those times.
The Fisher family has disavowed your book. They say it's unauthorized, and they don't know you, and you never reached out to them. How do you respond to that?
I did reach out to them. I wrote to their representative. I got a very nice email back, and I wrote to him again. I actually wrote to him twice before he answered, and then I wrote again and did not hear back. So I certainly told him about the book. I said I had a contract for it, and it's not unusual for writers of nonfiction books to get contracts before they go around and talk to a family. I mean, I've done that, and other people have done that, so that's not incredibly unusual, or maybe it's not very unusual at all. So they were contacted by me. Whether they want to remember it, whether they do remember it, that's up to them. I have a lot of respect for them, and obviously I did not feel good when that statement was released. But I mean, I know that I reached out to them, and I do feel that I did her justice.
Why were you interested in her?
She just was about as iconic as they come. I mean, I loved Postcards from the Edge. I was very aware of her significance in Hollywood. And when she died, it affected everybody. The outpouring was immense and amazing. And she became very clearly feminist, not even hiding in plain sight, but a feminist in plain sight. The women's marches followed suit, and girls who were not even born when Princess Leia hit the screen were holding up Princess Leia posters. So it just seemed her moment was, somebody had to, you know, write a biography of her, and I kind of raised my hand. I also grew up in Beverly Hills. I'm a little older than she is, but there was just a sense of knowing that world. But mainly, I think she was adored. She was incredibly honest. She was incredibly prolific. And her ability to, and necessity of telling the truth as boldly as she could and as humorously as she could, was something we kind of needed, and I felt that people implicitly knew that when they were holding up the Leia posters and talking about her so honoringly. So I did want to write about her.
Well, Sheila, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Sheila Weller. She's the author of the new biography, Carrie Fisher, A Life on the Edge. Princess Leia's theme, of course, by the composer John Williams. Well, coming up, another iconic movie from that time period, Blade Runner, set in Los Angeles in November 2019. What the 1982 film got right about the future. That's next on Press Play.